VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
Well, if I can't put this on my wall, like, why would I even want to own it? Like, forget about the technology for a moment that makes it possible. Like, why would I want to own it? I can't enjoy it, right? Even show it off to people or make it a part of my home, you know, that is part of my identity. But I think what that missed was that for a lot of people, their identity exists primarily online already.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. I'm your host, Danny Fortson, the West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times. We have a fascinating episode for you this week. On the program is Matt Hall, who is one half of the two-man design studio Larva Labs. And you may know Larva because they're the guys behind CryptoPunks, you know, the pixelated little cartoon characters that have become just a total phenomenon in the world of non-fungible tokens or NFTs. So last month, Dylan Field, you may have read, he's the founder of Figma, he sold one for $7.5 million. And here's the thing, there's only 10,000 of these CryptoPunks, and many of them are now fetching bids for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And Hall and his co-founder have made zero off of all this mania. All of the CryptoPunks that have been changing hands, they gave them away for free back in 2017. However, what they did do is keep 1,000. And I found out after we recorded that next month, they will be selling 9 of them in an auction run by the auction house Christie's. So chances are good that the Larva guys, who have helped launch this whole NFT mania, are about to walk away with, I would guess, at least $10 million, probably more. And they have hundreds more of these CryptoPunks. And again, this is something that they kind of created on a lark 4 years ago. They gave virtually everything away for free. And for years, not much happened. And now, well, now. Hey, it's 2021. So that's what I wanted to have Hall come on to talk about. Just how he got here, what he did before this, why he has become a believer in NFTs, and just the reality of sitting on digital assets that are suddenly worth tens of millions of dollars. So that's what we cover. I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's just yet another revealing look at what is happening in the world right now. These are crazy times. So without further ado, I give you Matt Hall, co-founder of Larva Labs and the creator of CryptoPunks. Enjoy. We're live. Thank you for making the time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
We had a brief talk a couple weeks ago, but I wanted to have you on just because I think what you're doing in the NFT world is just really interesting. So it's you and your business partner are basically Larva Labs.
Correct, yeah.
And so you've created CryptoPunks, which we'll get to, but if we could just go back and talk about kind of your background in this world and how you got to this point creating CryptoPunks and everything that's happened since then.
Oh, yeah, sure. So me and my partner, John, basically have been working together for about 20 years or so and have run a company together, Larva Labs, for about 16 of those years and have just always kind of enjoyed writing software. Basically, we just have done it all our lives, kind of met each other in college and just kept working on projects together. And then some of those turned into a business, especially we were very early on mobile phone software. We worked on a phone called the T-Mobile Sidekicks, what it was called in the States.
What was the Sidekick?
It was like a pretty incredible device, really. It was like basically a proto smartphone. It had a lot of the features that we now are that are common in smartphones, but it existed really early on. And it was sort of marketed as almost a teen phone for teens, like about texting and about like, you know, instant messenger. But it had like basically everything that a smartphone had. It had a persistent always on network connection, and it was really robust.
Right.
So you could be in like an AIM chat and go, you know, lose connection and come back and it was fine. It would queue the messages.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas like, I think back then, you know, there like a comparable smartphone would be like a Trio something or another.
Like Palm from Palm.
Yeah.
And may Palm rest in peace.
Exactly. And Palm had some super cool stuff too, but at least in this era, to get on the network was like almost like dialing up to connect to the network.
Yeah.
And you download your email and then disconnect. Whereas this was basically connected all the time.
It's so funny that that was like a thing because, you know, back then, obviously things were very different. Because this is what, mid 2000s?
Yeah. I believe the first version of that phone was released in 2000 or 2001. And then we started, they basically released a developer kit for it and then had an app store for it. And it was done through what's called carrier billing. So that whatever you bought would just appear on your phone.
Right.
And so it was done in partnership with T-Mobile. And it was like a very early version of what we're all used to now as this huge business.
That's so funny. As you think, it's kind of like thinking about Facebook, which was like the, you know, whatever, the 20th social media app or the 50th. I can't remember what the number is, but it's the social network now, but it obviously wasn't even close to the first. And T-Mobile Sidekick was like pre-iPhone.
yeah, more or less. It had some stuff that I still miss. Like it was a keyboard-based phone and it had a lot of shortcuts. So you'd get very fast with it. And I would just use it to write email, even if my computer was sitting there sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily do with an iPhone or something like that today. But so we basically like were one of like 30 developers for that phone. You know, it was a pretty small group of people that did it. And we started the company, basically, the Larva Labs, to have a company to receive the payment from the store. Like, it's like, well, we need to open a bank account and get like these royalty checks. So that's why we formed the company. And then that went really well. And we basically went full time working on that. That's all we did for a few years was write apps for the Sidekick. And then Android came along and iPhone, of course, and a portion of the company that made the Sidekick, the company's called Danger. And a portion of that company left and started Android.
Right.
And so, and then Google bought them, and obviously that became Android.
Yeah.
So we knew some of those people a little bit, and we were working with Google early on, and then as we kind of transitioned to doing iPhone and Android apps, we did a lot of work with Google, and we just kind of tried to leave enough time in the year to do other stuff. Like, and some of it was just straight up experiments. Like, this is just a funny idea or a cool idea. It's not a business. There's no way. And some would be attempts to like do a startup or actually like do something that would earn revenue. So sort of in that spirit, about 4 years ago now, was one of those experiments was the CryptoPunks. And I would put that in the experiment category for sure.
So what was the idea, the initial idea?
So the idea was, came from the artwork, basically, was where it started. And John was working on this character generator. And we thought we'd use it for a phone app. The initial idea was like, maybe it'd be fun to have a collectibles app in your phone and you got a new one every day and you could trade them with your friends. And that felt kind of fun, but it felt like it was missing something a little bit. And that, you know, if we told you, oh man, this is you just got the rarest one. You're like, okay. Like, but all I have to know that for sure is you telling me, like, I don't know that for sure, you know?
Yeah.
So there's just something a little lacking about the idea. And it was around then we started, like, as we were working on the generator bit, we discovered Ethereum, found out that it was a whole platform for, you know, development, and you could run software on this blockchain, and that seemed pretty cool.
Yeah.
So then we kind of figured out that, oh, these like tokens, like the code that governs issuing of new tokens, we could maybe modify that to refer to unique items.
Right.
And so then if we pair that with some number of these things being generated by this algorithm, like these punks, then we could make like, oh, there's a new version of this kind of collectibles feeling. It's like, it's digital, so it's kind of ephemeral, but it's verifiable. You know the number, you can prove that it's rare. That's kind of interesting. So that's kind of how it started.
In 2017, that was the same year that CryptoKitties came out, right? Because that was the first kind of what we now call NFT project that really caught fire, at least for a few weeks.
Yeah. So the timeline there is that we released CryptoPunks in like early summer, so June.
Yeah.
And then I think CryptoKitties came out in the fall. And and CryptoPunks went well, but then CryptoKitties was like a phenomenon. You know, it took over Ethereum basically. And we thought like, oh, damn, you know, like they kind of swamped us here and everybody knows about CryptoKitties and not everybody knows about CryptoPunks.
And do you have any sense of why CryptoKitties got super popular and CryptoPunks, while doing kind of fine, didn't, at least at that time?
That's an interesting question. And I think I haven't thought about that directly too much, but my guess would be that what CryptoKitties had was like, it was a more polished product at the time.
Mm.
Like ours was really like an experiment on our website. It was like a little hard to use. And,
yeah.
And they took that idea and were like, okay, what if we, you know, sort of level up some of these things, just make it feel more like a consumer product with the proper login. And, you know, you're getting proper
right.
notifications and all this kind of stuff, but also their dynamics of the way that they're like, ours is a fixed set. And that was kind of our idea, was like, yeah, there's 10,000 of these things. They arrive completed. Like the set is done. We
yeah.
can't add anymore. There won't be anymore. And then CryptoKitties was not that. It was like, you can make new ones and they're made in these interesting ways and you can, you know, create potentially new rare-ish ones. And that felt very dynamic, I think, at the time. And it felt a little bit more in the category of a game. And it made us maybe even think a little bit like, oh, is ours a little too simple to be sustainable? That it's like, all you can do is buy and sell and own these things. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's fine to sort of prove the concept, but maybe it's not enough to engagement day to day. So CryptoKitties seemed to have that advantage at the time. And I think maybe long term now, like since we're several years out, that proved hard to sustain in the sense that there was a large supply of them. Is one thing. And it's sort of complicated to get into. So it's like, it is a bit of a game. So as long as there's enough people playing it, then it's worth getting into. But whereas ours, like, has just been the same since the beginning, basically. So
can you just explain what CryptoPunks are and like what the launch was? You mentioned the scarcity. I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what they are is a piece of code that runs on the blockchain on Ethereum, which if you're not familiar with like what that means, what it specifically means is that we don't control it anymore and we don't even run it anymore. So it's run by this sort of group of people who come together and all verify that something is correct.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that is that when we released it, we said there's 10,000 of these things. It's in the contract. You can go see it. It's called a contract when it runs on Ethereum.
Yeah.
And you go take a look at it and you say like, oh, there's the number, there's 10,000 and I can verify this can't be updated. There's no way to change it. So we're done here. Like this is the number. And we sort of explicitly made there's no admin functions in that contract. There's no way for us to affect the operation of it, which is kind of a high wire act in that you have to get the thing perfect the first time out.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But if you do that, then you have this thing that we haven't touched for 4 years now. It has certain sort of powerful advantages to do with like trustworthiness and so on.
Yeah.
But the first while is pretty scary because you're worried that there's going to be problems with it potentially and you can't really affect it.
You released 10,000
yep.
and you gave them away for free?
Yeah, we kept the first 1,000 and we gave away 9,000. And so meaning like they just people had to pay the network transaction fee, pay the fee to Ethereum, which at that point was between 10 and 25 cents. It's pretty cheap. Now it's
right.
kind of expensive because the network's really busy. So that was the price to get a CryptoPunk back then. And it didn't even go to us. We got nothing out of those 9,000. And the idea was, well, let's just not have there be, this is an experiment. Let's just not have there be any reason for people not to do it. You know, let's find out if people are into it. If it grows, it'll grow organically and let's give it every chance to do so. And then the other part of that code is the marketplace. Because it was so early, there was no sort of third-party marketplace as there is today. So it needed mechanisms for bidding and for offering for sale and transferring them, you know, things like that. So
right.
so there's also a fully functioning marketplace attached to it, which also has no fees. We felt that was also important. So all those transactions are sort of as frictionless as you can be on the blockchain, at least.
So there's 9,000, you released them, people... Well, and they're not even buying them, but they're paying the transaction fee to take ownership of them for, say, 25 cents or a couple bucks or whatever it was. Can you talk about, like, what's the volume of deals in terms of dollar value that has happened in the last 2 months for CryptoPunks?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because at first that number was zero. Like the first few days, it was really slow. We literally couldn't give them away. And then after a week or so, it got discovered and there were some articles written about it. And then it switched. The free stuff, you know, the free phase ended quickly, and then it became the market, secondary market, and things started selling for a little bit of money. You know, you probably average price $20, but some were selling for a couple $1,000s, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
When you've just gone from this being, I don't know whether this will work at all, to somebody paying $1,000 for something seems amazing. But then now fast forward almost 4 years later, and I think the overall volume now is $250 million or something like that. And probably 200 of that has been in the last 2 months.
$200 million of people paying for CryptoPunks in the last 2 months.
Yeah. And of course, we get none of that because we take 0% of fees, which is like, you know, now that the numbers are substantial, it's like, well, that would have been nice maybe. But I think also we stand by that decision just in the sense that, like, it's partly, I think, why we're here, you know, that it felt like this kind of whole pure project there. No reason not to participate in it, for at least in terms of that. So, yeah, it's been quite a ride.
But you still have 1,000.
Yeah, we have less now. We've sold some, but we still have the majority of them. Yep.
And so what's a new crypto, like what's the floor price for like a CryptoPunk now if you have like, I don't know, 800 or 900 of them?
It varies. The floor price obviously fluctuates. Right now it's about $40,000. So that's the cheapest CryptoPunk available on the market is $40,000.
40 times 1,000. Just doing my math. That's a lot of money potentially for you and your founder.
Yeah, potentially. And it feels like very theoretical in the sense that you'd have to sell them all to get to realize that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it is quite crazy. Yeah, it's been, and things have changed so dramatically just with the NFT world in the last couple of months.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask. So if you're theoretically on 40 million-ish of these assets, is that just a complete mind, I won't drop an F-bomb here, but you know what I mean. I mean, that must be just completely weird to like 2 months ago be like, oh, this thing is actually gaining some momentum. This is pretty cool to all of a sudden like, oh my God, this stuff we have that we created for free and gave away for free is now worth potentially tens of millions for us personally.
Yeah, it's crazy for sure. Like there's no other way to put it really. You don't have something change that dramatically and it feel normal. That's for sure. And I guess like what I would say is that there was a quiet period in this project that lasted about, you know, a year and a half or so where there was bead sales here and there, you know, and even we were buying them back because people were selling them for cheaply. And we just felt like we had kind of convinced ourselves. We didn't really understand what it was when we first released it. It felt interesting, but we didn't really get it. But after talking to people about it, we kind of figured out, I think, what it was and then felt pretty strongly about it being a thing that really worked. And so our outlook on it turned into like, long term, this feels like something that's going to work.
Right.
And the time frame, I have no idea, because right now it's a pretty small niche thing with like a, you know, a dedicated community that believes in it and is into it. But it might be a niche for a long time. It feels like long term it'll work out, but what does that mean in time? I don't know. And then to have it suddenly sort of flip to be mainstream in the period of 3 months, like,
yeah,
was pretty crazy. Yeah.
The train is now approaching junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And was there, and I've talked to a few people in the NFT world now, but do you have any sense of why NFTs just like exploded? Obviously, the Beeple sale was the big thing that caught everybody's attention, you know, $69 million for a digital art piece. But this started before then.
Yeah, I think so, because we were seeing signs of adoption for, I would say now, certainly since the pandemic began,
when
we started seeing an increase in activity. And we had seen sort of behavior of people that indicated that it could be a thing, in the sense that people really felt ownership over these things and they felt like emotionally attached to them in a way that you would normally maybe only associate with like a physical ownership.
Right.
But we were hearing people talking about how they hated to sell them and that it didn't matter what the price was. There's no way I'm selling this. And something they might've bought for $40 or gotten for free even, and they're being offered all this money and they're like, I can't do it, you know?
Really?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And obviously not, there have been lots of sales, but we were hearing things like that. And, you know, and there's analogies too, like Fortnite skins and other like massive marketplaces
for sure,
purely digital as well. That sort of adjacent behavior as well. So we felt like there's some indications here this could be possible. So maybe that was kind of all around, like those kind of like conditions for this to work were around. And then the pandemic forced everybody to go online exclusively, and that accelerated that time frame. That's a possibility. So I guess the summary there is we saw some of the signs, but when it actually did that ramp up, when people decided that it was a thing, was pretty dramatic.
And do you have a sense, especially as kind of life gets back to quote unquote normal, that this will kind of lose momentum? Because especially in the crypto world, things kind of go crazy and then they crash and then they go crazy and they crash. But generally, the kind of trajectory is up. And I don't know if you are seeing any signs one way or the other, especially as, you know, vaccines roll out and people are actually leaving their houses again and not just glued to their computer all day long.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I don't know if the dramatic increase in time we spent online sort of drove the feeling of ownership or just, you know, when people would get to go outside again and hang out with people, will it drop? I'm not sure. Like, I feel like we've discovered something here. Like, I mean, we meaning everybody.
Yeah.
We've sort of all discovered the thing, like, we like this stuff, you know, like we feel like we want to do it. And there's lots of reasons why people want to participate. Either they come from a collector's mentality and it's an extension of sports memorabilia, or
they're
into art and this is like an art market and so on. So there's lots of ways for people to want to get into it. I don't know, like I hesitate to make any short-term predictions. I just feel like that's the thing that I'm kind of most focused on, is that it feels like lots of people are participating in this because they want to, because they feel like it's an interesting thing that kind of makes sense to them. So I don't feel like that'll go away even when they have other options of things to do, you know?
Yeah. We had the guy on the podcast this week who was part of the investment group who spent $200,000 on the LeBron James highlight, the NBA Top Shots.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 31 and he's been messing around with Bitcoin since he was in his early 20s. And for him, there's no distinction. He obviously understands there's a distinction between the kind of real world and the digital. But for him and his generation especially, they're kind of like, well, we kind of grew up online. That line doesn't really exist in the way that it would for kind of older generations, which I do think is also part of this, of just like, yeah, it's digital, but like, so what? Might mean it's more valuable, not less.
There's a good argument for that, for sure. And that was the, you know, in the earliest days of this, when we would talk to people related to the art world, the question would be like, well, if I can't put this on my wall, like, why would I even want to own it? Like, forget about the technology for a moment that makes it possible. Like, why would I want to own it? I can't enjoy it, right? Even show it off to people or make it a part of my home, you know, that is part of my identity. But I think what that missed was that for a lot of people, their identity exists primarily online already. This is going to be something that comes out of that. You know, they're already focused on the likes on Instagram and how they're perceived in various ways there. So this is an extension of that. It feels very natural. It's not, that question doesn't come up as much as it used to. It basically doesn't come up at all anymore, because I think the people who are into it now are like, like you're saying, just find it totally natural.
Yeah. 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 And I know that blockchain is anonymous, but do you know who, obviously the Figma founder is the one who spent, was it $7.6 million on one of the CryptoPunks, but do you know who this, is there a kind of a generalization you can make about who is buying this stuff? Is it generally younger people or is people from the art world or creative industries, or do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, it's changed dramatically in the past few months is also what's kind of interesting about it. And it was the founder of Figma who sold an alien.
Yeah, that's right, right.
Yeah, but what we're seeing is like it just kind of crossed over into being almost a cultural thing. And so it went from being, for the previous 3 years of the project, it's been people who are into crypto and then into this,
Yeah.
And now it's turned into like a cultural thing. It's like a thing to own, like a piece of art or a rare collectible or something. So it's just all across the spectrum. You see people online who are just famous YouTubers and people who, it's really gone across the whole spectrum, which is also makes me think that it's something that will have a life to it, because we always wondered a little bit like, is this just a niche of cryptocurrency, which is kind of a niche within the world. But since it's almost become the way in which crypto is bridging into the real world, because it has this cultural attachment to it.
Yeah. And just personally, and I don't know how well you have done up to this point with your company and various things you've been doing, but like, did you ever think this thing could potentially bring you life-changing money, like never have to work again type money?
No, yeah. And it's pretty funny because we always we've tried to do mobile startups, right? We were super early on mobile. So we had some things we were working on in the early days of Android. And we saw people we knew become very successful in the early days. And then that window kind of closed a bit and it became extremely competitive on the App Store. And we were like, well, guess that's over,
Yeah,
and
missed that boat,
and felt kind of stupid about it in retrospect, because we were like, that's what we should have done. And obviously it's in retrospect, that's the whole point. But not really thinking in those terms. And this project wasn't made with that in mind. Like some of those other apps we made, we thought like, okay, this is an experiment, but it could turn into something. And this wasn't created with that in mind. So it's surprising of all the things that we've attempted, and there's been a lot, that this is the one that has gotten this kind of life to it.
What's a lot? Like, how many different schemes and ideas and projects and companies have you guys done?
Like a lot. Like, we tried to put it together because we didn't really even have a record of it. We just make stuff and then throw it away. And at some point, we realized like, well, this is going to be a kind of our career. We should at least know what we've made.
Yeah.
So even just as an example, for the Sidekick back then, we made, I think, 30-something apps just for that in the first 3 years.
Wow.
And then since then, there's probably been another maybe 20 things or something like that. I don't know. We tried to collect a bunch of them and put them on our website. And after a while, it was just like, well, let's just do the highlights, because some of them truly are like experiments, and they've been embarrassing because they were designed to test something, didn't work. We didn't really put in the effort the edges to make it look nice. So we're like, let's not highlight that one. But but certainly quite a few things. We like to joke that we've kind of like done one of everything. People will ask us like a question about something like, oh yeah, I remember we tried this one thing related to that. So quite a few things.
And is this it for you for NFTs, or are you guys working on something else? Because it sounds like, as you say, the deeper you've got into this, you guys have obviously been doing this longer than virtually everybody. The more people you talk to and kind of understand why people are buying this stuff, it seems to have redoubled your conviction that this is a thing. So are you going to be doing other things?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and we've been working on something new for a little while. We have a follow-up project of the CryptoPunks, which we released in 2019, called the Autoglyphs. And
the Autoglyphs.
Yeah, then that's that was a reaction almost to what we had been talking about, when the questions we were getting about what is this thing, and what is, especially specifically the question of what is on the blockchain, which was a big concern in the early years of this project. Like, is the art on the blockchain, was sort of one of the big questions we would get. And the answer is kind of no. There's a link to the art, but the actual images are not stored there.
Yeah.
And they're widely available and they're provable that they're the ones that are represented by the blockchain, but the images themselves weren't on there. So we thought like, Well, it would actually be interesting to be able to answer yes to that question. Like, yes, everything is on the blockchain. So that's what the autoglyphs are. They're a generative algorithm, and the output from that is stored all in the blockchain as a permanent record.
And these are kind of other types of characters.
These are not characters. This is a more like abstract generative art. Sort of an homage to the early days of computer generative art.
Oh, I see.
Because the blockchain is like not, doesn't have that much computational muscle. It's like, because everybody does every calculation,
yeah,
you kind of can't do that much. It's actually quite expensive. So it's very limited. So it's, in many ways, it's similar to the very earliest days of computers when they just didn't have many capabilities. So
yeah.
Sort of the art looks like a little bit from that era as well.
I see.
Yeah. So that's what we did in 2019. It has become quite successful too. It's a limited set. It's only 512 of them, but they're quite expensive now too. And I think it's sort of a different audience that's into those.
What is quite expensive? Like, what do you mean?
I think they're the cheapest one of those is probably around $80,000.
And the most expensive?
The most expensive is, I'd have to look. I think it's definitely several hundred thousand dollars.
Wow.
If not more. Yeah, and there's some rarity built into those as well, just by the way that the algorithm works and stuff like that. So that's been interesting to see that as well. And even generative art has kind of found a home on the blockchain now. There's I'd say a much larger fan base of generative art, which we didn't see as something that might happen back when we made the autoclips. We thought it would be a pretty limited audience for it, so we made a fairly small set.
And did you keep any of those?
Yep, we kept some of those too. So same model. Actually, this one we actually charged some money for it, but we donated the money to a climate change charity.
Oh, cool.
So we couldn't just straight give it away because enough people knew about us from the CryptoPunks that it would have just been grabbed by the first person that got there. So we wanted to have a little bit of a reason to not just go crazy on it. So,
right.
So that was a nice way to kind of do that.
Right. And so can you talk about what's next, or is that still under wraps?
Still under wraps, but it's another sort of reaction to what, just sort of as we learn about this stuff and as we've been sort of maintaining and running the CryptoPunks through these years and just watching what people do with them and what they wish they could do with them. And so a lot of what we're working on now, I think we'll be attempting to address some of the shortcomings of what's just, you know, in the market in general, like what you can't do with NFTs right now.
Right.
Is our hope, at least.
Cool. Have you splurged at all? Have you like got like a sports car or the kind of like?
That's what's also hilarious about all this is that it's still like pandemic, right? So I'm just like, everything's exactly the same. Like everything's just, everything else has changed and everything that like in my immediate vicinity is exactly the same. I bought a new mouse. That was it. That's pretty exciting.
I bet you it's a beautiful mouse.
It's really one of the best mice you can get. I mean, I think it was $65, which is, I mean,
that's an expensive mouse. Well, cool. Well, look, it's super interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time. And let us know when your next thing is unveiled.
Will do. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Matt for taking the time to talk about all things CryptoPunks. Don't you wish you would have made some? I sure do. Or I wish I would have got some for, 10 cents back in 2017. What did I know then? Anyhow, thank you for listening. If you haven't, please just take a moment right now. Give a rating and review to the podcast. It really does help. And if you've already done that, thanks. I'll be writing about a whole bunch of techie type stuff in the Sunday Times, so do pick up the paper or log in at thetimes.co.uk, or find me on the Twitters at Danny Fortson. You can email me with any questions, concerns, comments, suggestions, ideas for guests, whatever, at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk. That is all for me this week. I hope you guys have a fabulous weekend, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.